Führung, Selbstwirksamkeit und Unternehmenserfolg. Und das mit Fokus, Leichtigkeit und Energie. Geht nicht? Doch! Holt euch spannende Einblicke und interessante Denkanstöße in der Leadership Lounge. Von und mit Laura von der Gröben. Also Platz nehmen und zurücklehnen.
I'm very, very happy to have a special guest here today. You see me, I'm like smiling all over my face. He's bringing with us to this podcast a very deep understanding of the human psyche, but he also carries big legacy with him because today we have here Jeffrey Zeig. And he is known as like an old student of Milton Erickson. Milton Erickson, who, for those who don't know Milton Erickson, I think everyone knows him, but for those who don't know him, he's like, he made a switch on the understanding of hypnosis. And he's like the father of the modern way how we do hypnosis. And Jeff had the honor to learn from him for 7 years. And if I understand it right, because you're so thankful of that, your idea was to give it back and to then to teach other people his legacy. And Jeff wrote a lot of books. I think I read about, if I'm right, about 20 different books. In my bookshelf, in the background, I have 4 big books of you. So that's pretty cool. And yes, I'm really, really happy that you are here with us, Jeff.
It's my honor. I'm glad to be here and support your mission too.
Thank you very much. Yes, I normally start my podcast with a random question, and it's always a surprise because it's a game on my mobile phone, but I love to play it to start. So we will start it with a random question. Oh, this one is a good one, and it's good for our podcast, because what's an idea or teaching that created a paradigm shift for you?
Yes. Well, really, it was art that created a paradigm shift. Psychotherapy has been in the world of science, where it's based on theory and technique and research. And that's great if you want to help somebody change their cognitive understanding. If people came to therapy because they needed to understand how do they get out of depression? What are steps 1 through 4 for getting out of depression, anxiety, bad habit, and ineffective relationship? Therapy would be easy, but there are things that can't be gained by a logical algorithmic approach. What you said about Erickson was true. The history of hypnosis before Erickson was like this. You were putting suggestions into a passive person, and you were feeding something in that was missing. What Erickson was doing was this. He was doing eliciting, awakening from people, realizations that would empower them. Now, this is what happens when you go to an art museum, when you practice music, when you engage in dance, when you go to a theater. They don't try to instruct you about what's important in life. They present an evocative experience that has the capacity, but not necessarily the initiative to awaken you. So art works from a more eliciting point of view. And when I could understand that, then I could have a more artistic ways of helping clients rather than informative ways of helping clients. There's nothing wrong with information as long as information works. Sometimes information is necessary. You need to explain to someone the side effects of a medication that they're using. But if you want somebody to be motivated, happy, connected, responsible, curious, those things need to be stimulated into play, and they can't just be algorithmically informed. So that was the understanding that I've been working with, and it's kind of obscure. It's an obscure understanding in the field of psychotherapy, because a lot of it is based on having a scientific approach that can be researched and codified with a manual. If you have a right manual, you just read through the manual and the person gets over their problem. But more of my work as I evolve as a therapist, I'm 76 years old now, is about developing, helping people to get realizations, the realizations that they need, rather than the cognitive understandings that are logical and could be helpful. So that is the area that I explore and write about and teach about in various places around the world when I get invited to be there.
That's a really interesting view, I think. And also it gives the therapy a kind of playfulness. So I remember when I started with my first coaching sessions, and I thought there's the one perfect answer and I need to find the one perfect answer. But of course, there's not. There are so many ways and you never know which one is the right one. And then I gave myself as a present, like a little present on my desk in my office. And it reminded me of, okay, today we wrap the present and we will see what will come out of it. And you can just trust your intuition and do what comes from your heart. And after I started it, to do it like that, it became so much more easy. And I think also I helped the people better, or I could help them better. And I think that's this idea of play, to put in some playfulness.
I agree with you 100%. I think that out of all of the master therapists that I had the blessing of learning from, Erickson was one of the ones who was most playful. And therapy was like a game to him, and an appreciative inquiry and not a scientific inquiry into human beings.
I work a lot with leaders from companies, and I find they are often like stuck into this idea that they need to do things perfectly. What would you advise them to add some of the playfulness in their life?
Yeah, well, I would advise them to do things imperfectly, not perfectly. And perfection is overrated. I don't know many areas where perfection exists. There's no perfect novel. There's no perfect music. There's no perfect painting. Everything is an approximation. And we have in our mind the idea that we can do things perfectly, but the reality of the situation is that we're imperfect creatures and we're just experimenting our way through the world, trying to do our best at finding things that add joy and meaning to life. And pursuing the perfect is a sure path to failing, because there is no perfect to pursue. Everything that we do will wind up being imperfect. But it's a program that is common in the world that people try to do things perfectly, set the perfect table for dinner or make the perfect menu. And perfection is an ideal phantom. It's a ghost that we often try to pursue, but if we pursue perfection, we will always wind up failing, because it's very hard to define. I don't know what a perfect therapy session would be. I don't know what perfect art would be, what a perfect movie would be. I only know that there are approximations. A perfection is an asymptote. An asymptote in geometry is the line that approaches an axis but never really reaches it. Mm-hmm. There's always a gap between our principles and our practice, and we can pursue excellence. That makes sense to me, but pursuing perfection doesn't hold much interest to me.
Yes. As you were telling us that, I just thought about finding also the beauty in the imperfection. And I have also a picture for that in my mind. I remember when I've been into an art museum in Rome, I think 5 years ago, and there was like this really nice picture of Monet, but something was odd with it. And then when I came nearer, it was written that it was built by a machine, so it was like a copy. And somehow the soul was missing of this
Yes.
picture. And I don't know why, but I felt it before I read like the subtitle of the picture, but something was off. And maybe that's the when we try to do things perfect, if we would really reach perfection, then it's something would be odd.
It would be odd because you could perhaps reach a standard of perfection with a machine, but in human engagement, there isn't any perfection that can be reached or defined. I don't know what a perfect therapy session would be. I've never done one.
I think no one did. But nevertheless, sometimes there are moments where you want to excel and you want to really give your best. Like not, I mean, I think now it's clear there's not the perfect way, but at least to reach the best version of us to do a
Yes.
good job.
I'm writing a book right now about mastery, like what does it take to be a master therapist? And I'm centering the book on three steps, using representations, like a metaphor is a representation. If I say you're a lion, that could mean you're strong or you're a leader or that you have a lot of vitality, but it's not clear. It's just a metaphor. You're not really a lion. And writers use metaphor and representation in their work. Like if Shakespeare has Romeo say, Juliet is the sun, that's just a metaphor. But we get the feeling of knowing that Juliet is incredibly special to Romeo. Doesn't mean that she's necessarily bright or luminous or that she has a great complexion. It's just a metaphor. So master therapists use representations. Like I was seeing a client today and I was saying to the client, you want to be here. And I was using a gesture as a representation. Right now you're here. Don't try to do this. Just get yourself like this. So I was speaking representative language, which is unusual in psychotherapy as a tool, rather than using logical language. Using strategic development is another area that I keep on practicing. I'm talking to you, we're talking about things that are important, we're talking about things that are about excellence. We want people to develop their excellence. Now I'm speaking in a series of steps, D, 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 dum. And this was a characteristic of Erickson, speaking in strategic steps rather than speaking so directly to people. So one avenue of developing excellence is representation. One area of developing excellence is using strategic development. One area of excellence is using embellishments, elaborations. And I mean by that making things more vivid or sometimes making things less vivid. Some writers, like a writer like Ernest Hemingway, would use short, terse sentences, and you would get the felt sense of what he meant. Other writers, like Faulkner, would use more complex sentences, more elaborate sentences to convey meaning. And so I'm trying to write this book about what are some steps to mastery, what are some categories. And those are the three that seem most predominant to me. And I practiced them, but probably not enough. And I try to institute them so that they're part of my procedural memory. I don't think about them, I just do them. And it's like tying my shoes. I don't have to think about tying my shoes, I just do it. It's been practiced so many times that it's just a procedure. And these are three areas where I'm working to improve my own excellence as a communicator, as a therapist. And I'm writing about it now to encourage other people and see if they're interested in exploring some of the same themes.
This is quite interesting. I'm thinking about I'm still like recapturing now the thing, and now my synapses are connecting and making new dots. So I'm sorry for the short break. Because that's a new for me at least, it's a new perspective to see things.
When I learned therapy in 1970s, it was about words, use the right words. And it didn't therapy wasn't something that appealed to people's ears or appealed to people's eyes or required the therapist to get out of the chair and move around the room. And it was limiting the tools that were available to the therapist. And if the person said, I'm sad, I would say, you seem a little down right now. And I would be using empathic reflecting to show that I understood the emotional understructure of the patient's situation. Now I would use sounds or gestures or postures or expressions or metaphors. And try to add more liveliness to the communication by making it possible to use the totality of what's available to me in communication. Like if we look at what Rembrandt was capable of doing compared to what Picasso or Miró was capable of doing, what Rembrandt was doing was genius, and it was expressing a perspective of showing people what was. If you look at young Rembrandt versus old Rembrandt, you see a picture, a photograph of what was, but photographs didn't exist in Rembrandt's time. When photographs became invented, then artists could explore using colors and shapes and strange images and representations to try to make the art more three-dimensional and to make it come alive. So my area of inquiry in psychotherapy is how do we use the tools that are available to us as communicators to take a message? The message could be you can be responsible or motivated or curious or connected or responsible, and make that message come alive so that the person who I'm talking to can realize that message. And that requires me to think more like a movie maker or a painter or a composer than to think like a psychologist would traditionally think, just giving people the right tools, the right information. And a lot of times that does work, but when it doesn't work, we need to rely on other forms of communication. And I think it's relevant to parents. You know, every parent wants their child to be responsible. But if you explain to an adolescent why being responsible is a good idea, it's not necessarily going to help the adolescent be responsible. But if the adolescent does something experiential, joins a sports team, gets a pet, gets a part-time job, suddenly the experience prompts the realization of responsibility, and then it becomes something that's internal, rather than something that's imposed externally. So we learn both didactically and experientially, and we need to sort out what needs to be learned didactically and what needs to be learned experientially, and have the tools to help people to get where it is that they need to go. I was lucky to study with Milton Erickson, and that was for almost 7 years. And Erickson was in an interpersonal situation, an experiential communicator. If he had an idea like being more flexible, then he would tell stories about the flexibility of children, the flexibility of animals, the flexibility of cultures. And he would build the idea until it was something that came from the inside out rather than something that was imposed from the outside in. In an interpersonal situation, Erickson was artistic. He was an experiential communicator rather than a didactic communicator. But when it came to writing papers, and he wrote 100 of them, and contributing to books, he was very academic and used both sides of his brain, not just the experiential side. But in an interpersonal situation, if I wanted to learn something from Erickson, it was through artistic devices like stories and hypnosis and metaphors and assignments that would prompt me to be a better Jeff Zweig rather than just develop another technique in my mind.
And did you realize that from the beginning, or was there a
Not at
certain
all.
point where you were like, oh, this is like the aha moment?
The aha moment was relatively recent when I could explain Erickson more by looking at what artists were doing than looking at what scientists and academic teachers were doing. You know, I had an academic education, a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, a doctoral degree, and I had to memorize a lot of facts and theories and regurgitate them, but in order to get good grades, but they didn't really help me to be a better therapist. And Erickson was the most influential out of all of the teachers that I had in helping me to be a better therapist rather than just to know the rules and regulations of what adequate therapy was.
What is a story what you can remember in your time with Erickson where you got like this understanding or you learned really a lot at this moment?
There were so many. I'm thinking of one with another student, not me, that developed an understanding of my understanding of strategic processes. My friend David was going to see Erickson at about the same time that I was in the 1970s. And David presented Erickson with a problem and said to Erickson that he was spending too much money. And he was being frivolous rather than thoughtful about the way that he was spending money. And then he just waited, thinking that Erickson would just give him a hypnosis, and then suddenly he would be cured. And what Erickson did was to confront him and say, "Why are you wearing your hair so long?" And it was out of context, out of place, and brought back to David all of the feelings that he had of the confrontations that he had with his father about wearing long hair, which was popular then. And then Erickson said, "We'll meet the next day." And the session was over. And the next day, Erickson came in and said to David, "You know, you make money, and making money is a good thing, and you can buy books, and buying books is a good thing when you read the books that you buy. And making money is a good thing, and making money is something that you can do usefully, and you can buy clothes, and when you buy clothes, you can wear those clothes. And because you can buy books and you can buy clothes, you can buy yourself a savings account." Now, the idea suddenly became so delicious to David that he followed Erickson's directive, but Erickson's directive was step, step, offer. It was presented in a strategic sequence, which was more characteristic of Erickson. It's how do you gift wrap the realization that you want the client to realize. Now, movie makers understand this. We understand this as moviegoers. If the vehicle is traveling from the left to the right in the screen, we understand that the vehicle is going away. We don't have to have it explained to us. We just know that this movement is going away. This movement is returning home. And it's built into our experiential understanding. And if a movie director wants the action to happen within an office building, it's a series of steps. You see the office building, you're inside the office, the action takes place, and then the lighting or the scenery takes you into the next scene. Movie makers learn to think in terms of strategic steps that are involved in the realization of the audience, and the movie is created by using a series of steps. We don't think about it, we just enjoy it, and we are willing participants. So again, this is what I try to do in helping students to think strategically, to think about the steps of a presentation and not just the content of a presentation that they're making. So that was one of the things that I learned from Erickson. I should be able to think of more personal stories, but they escape me at the moment. I remember Erickson being angry with me. And that was my most stellar example of somebody being angry. And I was organizing a congress to celebrate Erickson's contributions to psychotherapy, and he was alive, and he was going to speak at the conference, but he died 9 months before the meeting and didn't have the opportunity. But I still had the opportunity to discuss with him who he wanted and what format he wanted for the congress. And it was getting late in the afternoon, and I was still throwing questions at him. And Erickson said, "Jeff." And I said, "Well, yeah." And I'm still charged with getting the task done. And he said, "You know, it's almost 6 o'clock." And I said, "Well, yeah, I know. I'm trying to go fast." And he said, "You know, at 6 o'clock, my animal program goes on television." I said, "Well, yeah, I know. He said, "Well, you know that I'm confined to a wheelchair." I said, "Well, yeah, I know. He said, "You know, I have no way of getting out of the house." I said, "Yeah, I know." He said, "Well, you know, if I don't get to watch my animal program, I get angry." I said, "I'm leaving." Now, it was such a beautifully artistic way of setting a limit that I never forgot at that moment. And I've tried to emulate that process when I've with the people who encroach on my life and try to do something that represents the elegance of what Erickson did with me and try to pass on that spirit to other people, whether they're therapists or business people or mothers or fathers or adolescents, and try to use that kind of a story to illustrate a principle that you don't need to do this. You can do dee, 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 dee.
This is also, when I recall it right, when I was at the seminar with you in Rottweil, you told the story that Erickson gave you a letter and just let you read like the first part of it, and then asked you what is the last sentence, or how does the letter end?
Yes, it's a book, actually, and it was a book called Nightmare Alley, which was made into a recent movie. And the movie doesn't have the particular intelligence that the writer had in the book. So Erickson gave me the book. He said, "Read the first page." I read the first page. He said, "Now tell me what it says at the end of the book. Tell me the end of the book." I had no idea. I said, "What does it say?" He said, "Read the book." So I read the book. I got to the end. I went back to the first page. And I realized that the author had planted a seed, and that if I knew how to read in terms of strategic development, I would have recognized that seed. Now, this is the same that Beethoven does, or that Schiller does in his writing, that every great writer, every great composer creates a reference to a future activity, the overture of a symphony is a reference to the music that you're going to hear, and it adds familiarity to what you will eventually hear. And we know from the science of psychotherapy that priming an idea increases the activation of the idea when it's presented later. There are a lot of academic studies in psychology, the work of John Bargh, Bargh, is one of the leading proponents of studying priming. This may be new to psychology, but it's certainly not new to music, and it's not new to literature. And Erickson was pointing out that a very good writer was providing a hint, and the hint was something that I should have recognized because it was a little out of place, but I contextualized it. I made it just part of the story, and I didn't really read to understand how seeding was a strategic process that could be used effectively. I think that Erickson was a great reader. He was encyclopedic in his knowledge of literature, and that he had a way of dissociating himself to see what the structure of the writing was and not just be absorbed in the content. Mostly we look at a movie and we just are enjoying the way in which the storyline develops, and we're not paying attention to the artistry of how the movie is composed, the strategic structure that the director uses to develop the movie. So sometimes in my teaching, I use movies to illustrate principles and art to illustrate principles, and because we are expert at movies and we're expert at art, and if we can build on understandings that people have, then I can illustrate principles that I think are valuable for good communicators to develop.
So, what would be your advice for other psychologists or coaches to learn that kind of structure or to learn that that
There's
idea?
something. Yeah, what I do is when I'm on a flight and I can watch a movie, I watch the first opening scenes of the movie. And I try to predict where will the movie go, what will be the themes that are developed in the movie from the opening scene. I try to understand how the director, how the writer seeds the structure of the story. The Russian playwright Chekhov said that if the curtain of the play opens and there's a gun over the fireplace in the scene, somebody will get shot by the third act. Now, we don't pay attention to the fact that there's a gun over the fireplace, but on some level, we are being primed to have more of an emotional reaction when the gun is actually used later in the play. So this is something that Goethe used and Schiller used, and great writers use in developing their craft. And so, writing, art, poetry, music composition, movie making, these are arts. And to some extent, hypnosis is an art because you want somebody to have the experience of going into trance. And you can't just say to somebody, okay, go into trance. Now you should be hypnotized. You need to provide an induction that is an orientation that stimulates a realization in the person. And if we can do that for hypnosis, we can do that as a program in psychotherapy, and we can even do that as a program for our children and friends when we hope that they will realize something rather than ob objectively understand it. So this is the world that I explore, what needs to be taught, instructed, and what needs to be elicited and realized. It's not a common theme among therapists and teachers, but it's the theme that I'm interested in now. And so I keep on trying to develop interest in this theme and try to instruct people about when do you want to inform, when do you want somebody to realize something.
Absolutely. And As I understood you, it's like four steps, but can it also be like five steps or six steps or
Absolutely. Yeah. It's just set up, set up, set up, set up, set up, intervene. Step, 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 offer. And the last thing is exit. You're here, you're talking to me, we're talking about themes, about communication. We want to develop ourselves as better communicators because it will help be helpful to us in our future and helpful to the people we talk to. So it's entering in a series of steps, offering a proposition, and then providing a motivation that makes the proposition come alive. This is a dramatic arc that we're creating on a very subtle level in the communication patterns that we use.
Do you have an example for that? For example, for the case if someone tries to set boundaries and tries to say here, stop, but he can't, well, she can't do it because she's too afraid to get resistance, is it?
Yeah. Too afraid of the untoward consequence that could happen. And it's starting with pacing. We're here, we're talking about things that are important, we're talking about things that are interesting, we're talking about things that can help you to be more open in your understandings of what people are trying to offer you because your understanding will help you to be a better communicator and a better person and more effective in your life. So it's enter, 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 offer, exit. And the exit would be a reason for activating the offering. And it would be communicating in a dramatic arc. Step, 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 offer, exit.
Excellent, yeah. And those sequences, can they be like an hour long, or can they be like short, 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 and then there's an overall sequence the hour long?
Very well said. Yeah. I was remembering one videotape of Erickson that we make available to therapists to study. And it was over the course of 1 hour that he developed this dramatic arc and not just a sequence that I'm explaining, a short sequence, but developing it into a complex structure that would have the arc over an hour. But it's the same thing about reading a great novel. If you read something by Goethe, then you have the same dramatic arc developed over the course of a novel where it's building momentum to come to a denouement and then a satisfying ending. So that you feel that you've accomplished something through your reading. Right? Now that is true of music. It's true of literature, it's true of movies, it's true of poetry, but it really hasn't taken much impetus in the field of psychotherapy. We don't tend to think that art is communication and therapy is a communication art in many cases. We tend to put therapy in the area of science. Like if somebody has an infection and you're a physician, there's the right medicine to give them. You give them the right medicine, it cures the pathogen. They get over their infection. If somebody has a broken bone, there's a way to set the bone. You do the right way, and the bone is set. And but if it's when you have something that is an algorithm, like adding numbers is an algorithm, 2 plus 2 equals 4, it will always equal 4 when you add 2 plus 2. But to be happy, motivated, curious, respectful, engaged in the process of arithmetic, that's a different genre than memorizing the formula 2 plus 2 equals 4. So a lot of good things happen because of science. If you are sending a rocket to the moon, you have to know how much thrust you need to get the rocket off of the Earth and into space, and what trajectory you need to know to get it to the moon. But to be happy about sending a rocket to a moon, you don't need science, you need more art. So I'm trying to discriminate, when do you need a scientific approach? When do you need an artistic approach? But I can't tell you that I have a large audience that's interested in this type of orientation, because a lot of what happens in traditional psychotherapy is about the science of psychotherapy and not about the art of communication.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one reason why I find the Ericksonian way of thinking so interesting or so enriching, because it really helps. I like the idea of how to get the person to the moon, but also how to make him feel happy about that. And I find that at the moment we are like living in very complicated times, or very crazy times with AI, and also very interesting times on the same time. But what would be your recommendation that we can like feel happy and not so much stressed out about getting the newest ideas, and to not to focus too much on learning, but more on living.
Yes. Well, bad news, shocking news, sells products. So we don't blame our newscasters for telling us about the tragedy of the day. And the news isn't designed to add meaning and luster and happiness to our life. And the human brain tends to be a mismatch detector. It tends to notice what's wrong in any given situation, which is a good survival mechanism. If you eat one bad fruit, you remember it for a long time and you avoid eating that kind of fruit again. So, for survival, we need to notice what's wrong in any given situation. But to be happy, we need to notice what's right. We have a choice. When we look at a garden, we can look at the flowers or we can look at the weeds. And even if our tendency is to see the weeds in the garden, we can still find a way of reorienting our perception to see the flowers rather than the weeds. And this was part of the message of Erickson. And he lived it, because he was a man who was confined to a wheelchair. He had had polio. He was very restricted, didn't have much use of his arms or his legs when I met him. He was confined to a wheelchair. And he just perfumed the atmosphere with being glad to be alive, and was so inspiring in his presence that I just wanted to be around him to see how he lived. And I wasn't so interested anymore in learning about techniques of hypnosis or psychotherapy. I was much more interested in learning about life. And there's not a formula for being able to look at the flowers rather than the weeds. But there are certainly opportunities for us to to extol life and have more fun and add more joy and more meaning to whatever it is that we're doing with ourselves, our friends, our family, our colleagues. And that helps me to determine who I want for a friend.
Someone who enjoys life and really celebrates it.
Yes.
Yeah. I can go with that. Yes,
Yep,
totally understand that. Yeah, and on the same time, it's sometimes in the hurry of our everyday life, I find it sometimes quite complicated to bring myself back into, okay, what's really important to me? It's like you said, going to the na nature, going out into nature, to walk my dog, to sometimes just sit there and breathe and meditate, and or to look into the garden, which
be
makes me
present.
alive. Yeah, but in the stress of the day, sometimes we just forget.
It's very easy to forget, and it's very easy to go down the wrong path. And sometimes it's efficient to go down the wrong path because we learn about the problems. Again, the human mind seeks out problems to avoid, but doesn't necessarily get oriented to finding the joy that exists in any given situation. And when you find people who are addicted to bringing joy to life, those are people to stay with and to be with and to enjoy the journey with. Doesn't happen quite enough. I'm in my therapy office right now in Phoenix, Arizona, and what I encounter is one person after another person who is dealing with some problem, relational problem, financial problem, a social problem, friend problem, emotional problem, behavioral problem. So I am in a world where problems have precedence, and it's hard to convince people to look at the garden and see the flowers rather than the weeds.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, I find it with social media and also with AI much more difficult to really concentrate on stuff like that because it's too slow for us, because we are with our monkey brains, we are used to another shift, another flash, another effect. And then we see like the little things and we don't have the patience to get into the flow to enjoy it, I feel. And lately I'm thinking a lot about what are really future skills. And I think on the one hand side, it is to, of course, to understand those technologies, to be up to date with that. But on the other hand, it's also very important to find back to yourself, to, for example, meditate, to go to the nature, to really listen and to feel, because this is something what makes us special as humans or as living creatures, that we can really sense things.
Intelligent. Very intelligent. To concentrate on self-care rather than accomplishment. To concentrate on the things that bring joy to life rather than the things that are required and necessary and sometimes impossible to avoid. There are myriad problems in everyday life, and a lot of them get solved, and some of them just remain problems. But the opportunity for living joyfully, living meaningfully, is always available to us when we can remember to think in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. What would you say are future skills we need as as humans to stay sane, to stay happy?
Yeah, well, I was privileged to know Viktor Frankl, and he wrote Man's Search for Meaning. And that,
I love that book.
Yeah, so yeah. 6 million copies, or more than 6 million copies. And it was a study of meaning. And this was the guiding principle that made Frankl's life work. Is it meaningful? Then he would do it. If it's not meaningful, then he wouldn't have time for it. And I was lucky to meet him on a number of different occasions. I don't remember this situation, but I proposed something to him and he absolutely refused. And I was surprised because it seemed like a logical proposition. And when I was a little bit off balance, he said it wouldn't be meaningful. And that was the guiding principle that made him luckily survive through concentration camps and be able to contribute as much as he did. And The human heart, the human mind is a meaning-making organ. And if we can remember to make meaning the centerpiece in our life, we probably will live a happier existence than if we spend our time trying to fight the problems that are inevitable in the course of living.
Absolutely, absolutely. I need to tell you a story because it happened to me at the beginning of the week. Last was it last week? The seminar in Rottweil or 2 weeks ago? And I remember when your wife made like one exercise about the meaning of life, not the meaning of life, but the meaning of our job. And I work together with all those psychotherapists. And I mean, I do coaching with leaders, which is also meaningful, of course. But I was like, wow, you really give people like health. And I'm, yeah, just helping them to be more effective. So, and then I was really, okay, Laura, normally you think you have a really meaningful job. Why don't you feel it at the moment? And then I went back home and I thought about that thought. And last weekend I've been to a museum in Munich, to a modern museum, and there was one exhibition, and it really, really took my breath away. And after that, I needed to leave the museum because it touched me so, so much.
So
And
deeply.
it was just like a face projected into the air, and she talked about her job conditions, and it really shocked me what she was talking about, or this face was talking about. And then I read the subtext or the subtitle, and it was a job. It was an interview from 2020, so it was quite recently, and it was from a woman who works in Germany, and I was really touched about her. She had like a job where she had to w watch horrible movies to put them out of the internet, and she was not allowed to make breaks whenever she wanted, but she had like the times where she needed to make a break. So if she saw something really, really horrible, there was no way for her to make a break.
Process it. Yeah.
It really, also when I'm talking about it now, I feel really emotional again and really wow. And there I really found my my why or my sense again, because I don't want people to suffer like that in their daily jobs. And if I go out there, also my clients, they are sometimes job conditions. It's crazy that we work like that because we don't have to. It's just like our idea that we have to, but there's nothing in the outside who really makes us do it.
No.
And so I just realized lately, again, was getting back into touch about my meaning. So, yeah, I just wanted to share the story
I
with you.
appreciate your sensitivity and that you were open to understand and realize something about whether or not the prison house, relatively speaking, that we live in is really meaningful, but the restrictions of the job are one thing, and the pursuit of meaning is something else. And you were sensitive to the undercurrents and were able to tease out your own insight and your own initiative and your own direction, that you're not going to be trapped by the strictures of the system. The rules of the system are not going to define you, and you're going to find your way home,
Yeah.
so to speak. It's a great moment.
Yeah. I'm thank you that I could share it with you.
I'm glad you did.
Well, now I feel very touched and I forgot like the structure of my interview. But
Having a good conversation. It's in an area that could be of interest to your the people who watch your podcast. I hope it is of interest.
yeah, I think so. Yes, I think my last question was how to cope in those crazy times, and we spoke about that. Is there anything you want to give our audience what we didn't talk about, where you say, I want to tell, give you that like a present, what you can take home?
Well, the idea that we initiated about meaning, we create meaning by helping people, we create meaning by working, we create meaning by dealing with difficult challenges and overcoming the challenges as best as we can. So there are some areas that are available to us, and if we can remember to make things meaningful, even to the clerk at the supermarket or the bus driver that you see every day. And how can we add something that makes somebody's life just even momentarily a little bit better? And if we all entertain this idea, then some of the difficulties that are rampant in life won't have so much effect, and we'll be on a more evolved path in our ceaseless struggle to make moments important. I was thinking about a friend of mine, Irv Polster, one of the greatest Gestalt therapists in history, and he died 2 days ago. And I knew him for 50 years, and in various ways, and eventually as a collaborator. And he had such a nice way of making people feel important. He would make me feel important. And if we concentrate on making the people around us feel important, I think it'll be a better world, and it would have a cascading effect to others implicitly. And we're all trapped in the same situation, and we all need to decide a path. And if we can decide a path that adds something to humanity, it'll be a better world for all of us.
Absolutely. I like that thought as a yeah, as a good closing word.
It was a pleasure to spend time with you, and I hope that it was meaningful.
Absolutely. It was really, really meaningful to me. Is there anywhere where my audience can find you if they say, wow, I want to know more about Jeff Zeig?
Well, there's a lot of videos on YouTube in the Jeff Zeig collection, so people can find me on YouTube, and we've created a number of different series that are available, and some things are available from the Milton Erickson Foundation here in Phoenix, but we specialize in doing professional training more than speaking to the lay audience. I would advise people to go to YouTube and see if they find things that are interesting and valuable to them. It was a pleasure to spend time with you, and thank you so much for inviting me. And I feel better about myself for having the opportunity to be with you.
Thank you. I can give that back. It was a really, really great interview. It doesn't feel like an interview. It was more like a really, really nice conversation. And yeah, thank you for taking that time.
It's a pleasure.
Leadership Lounge von und mit Laura von der Gröben. Führung, Selbstwirksamkeit und Unternehmenserfolg. Und das mit Fokus, Leichtigkeit und Energie.